For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, a conversation with guitarist John Jorgensen about the music that he loves the most, the acoustic swing style of Django Reinhardt. A closer look at the local impact of the new Violence Against Women Act. And I'll talk with the great Carol Burnett about her love for classic movies and how it once got her fired from a job. Those stories are all next here on Arizona Spotlight. Guitarist John Jorgensen has played music with a host of stars, from Johnny Cash to Elton John, and his current band lets him play the music that he loves the most, acoustic swing in the style of Django Reinhardt. I'll talk with John Jorgensen about why that is and about his quintet's upcoming concert at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum.
Whenever I hear Django's music, it makes me feel good. You know, it's just so joyful and so much emotion and fun in it that it just makes me feel great.
What are some of the components of a gypsy-style jazz that we should let people know about?
Sometimes both of those words scare people off. You know, jazz, I know, does scare people off because they think it's going to be kind of cerebral. It might not be accessible, but gypsy jazz is very accessible and melodic. It's emotional. It's high energy. And you don't have to be a jazz fan, for sure, to like the music. The acoustic instruments, the guitar and the violin, especially, you know, being the lead voices, it's just a really pleasing sound. You know, it doesn't assault your ears, but it's got a lot of energy and emotion to it, as I say.
How do you first recall becoming aware of Django Reinhardt?
I've played guitar most of my life, and, you know, as kind of a student as well, I would read magazines and interviews, and Django Reinhardt's name started popping up in really disparate, I would think, you know, interviews, like somebody like Clarence White, for example, you know, talking about his flat-picking bluegrass guitar would mention Django Reinhardt, and then somebody like Jeff Beck would mention Django Reinhardt, and Chet Atkins would mention Django Reinhardt, and he was kind of influenced all of the iconic guitarists that we know of now. So pretty soon I said, hey, I need to check this guy out. It just blew me away. Even if he wasn't playing with only two fingers, it was just unbelievable guitar playing and the sound and the emotion and the spirit and the technique. It's all there. So immediately I started trying to learn how to play it. You know, that's basically what I'm like. If I like something enough, I want to be able to do it. So that was back in 1979. For many, many years, you know, I had a career in music that didn't really have anything to do with this style of music because I didn't see that there was really a venue or a circuit that I could perform. And that kind of changed around 2000. And people, I think because of the internet, and people started connecting with each other and realizing that there was a lot more people out there that, like you and me, that really love this music. And so they started having festivals here in the United States. And pretty much since 2003 now, this is what I've done full time, is touring and playing this style of music, which, you know, 20 years ago, I never went for it because it wasn't possible at that time.
And how is it for you as a guitar player, though, to try to use Django's fretting style? And describe how amazing it is that he did what he did.
Yeah, I mean, most players use four fingers on the fretboard, plus the thumb sometimes. And so there's a lot of scale patterns that you do like that. But as I said, Django only really had the full use of his first two fingers. So he created a whole style. And what it ended up doing is made him travel up and down the fingerboard a lot more than most players. And a guitar, you can play the same note down at the bottom of the neck and at the top of the neck, and they're going to have a different feeling different attitude, different tone. So that ended up making his music very much more colorful because he was using the full range of the guitar. You know, he created a lot of techniques, partially because he was trying to sound like Louis Armstrong on a trumpet. You know, they're such different beasts, the guitar and a trumpet, that it kind of pushed him to try to create some new techniques to sound like a trumpet.
Isn't that beautiful how influences work that way across instruments and across styles and across decades? Tell us about
across cultures and across continents. And,
yeah.
You know, Django was a Belgian-born French-living gypsy, you know, a Manouche gypsy. And, you know, Louis Armstrong was an African-American from New Orleans. So very little in common except music.
Talking about influences crossing over like that, tell us about somebody who was really influential on you when you were starting out who wasn't a guitarist.
Yeah, I used to watch Stan Kenton's band when I was a kid because my father worked with him. And so I got to see a lot of his concerts. So I would watch him on the piano. And, you know, that was definitely influential. I would hear a lot of other music, you know, on a regular basis. So I'm sure all of that kind of influenced my guitar playing, too.
And that guitar playing took you into the bands and on stage with some of the most amazing artists of the, what? How would we say it? I mean, some of the great artists of the 20th century.
It amazes me still to this day, you know, that I've gotten to play with, you know, pioneers of rock and roll like Little Richard and Johnny Cash and country icons like Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard. You know, people from my growing up era in the 60s, you know, I got to play with the Byrds and with Bob Dylan and with Michael Nesmith from the Monkees.
Well, what have you learned and taken from some of these guys in your own role as band leader?
Well, I think probably the most important thing is to really do whatever you can do to make all of the band members feel good about their contributions, especially when they're on stage. You know, it doesn't take much to let a musician know that you appreciate what they're doing in the moment, and that transfers to the audience. And because if, say, on the other side, if you've got somebody on stage that's not happy, they don't want to be there, and they don't feel appreciated, it's really going to drag down the energy of the whole show, even if they don't do anything, you know, obvious about it. So I think it's most important to keep everybody's vibe up and really keep focused on the music and remember that we're there to try to create magic for the audience every night.
John Jorgensen and his acoustic jazz quintet will perform at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum on April 12th and April 13th. The Desert Museum is an underwriter of Arizona Public Media. President Obama recently signed into law a new version of the Violence Against Women Act. This new version strengthens practices intended to prevent sexual violence against women, and it includes added requirements that universities and community colleges must meet in regards to sexual assault. Next, Fernanda Echavarri talks with representatives at the University of Arizona to find out how the UA Health Center will be affected.
National studies show 1 in 5 women are victims of sexual assault while in college. Dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking happen often, but many times go unreported. The updated version of the Violence Against Women Act includes a section known as the Campus Save Act that specifically targets universities. Megan McKendry is a violence prevention specialist with the OASIS program at the University of Arizona.
This new legislation, this component of the Violence Against Women Act that focuses on college students is really very comprehensive, and I was really excited to see this legislation come through personally. For us, I think in many ways it affects my job, and that I think it supports sort of the work I do already as a prevention educator.
She says the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act requires colleges to have outreach campaigns that educate students on the risks and resources surrounding sexual violence.
generally at colleges and universities nationwide and across different kinds of students, alcohol is one thing that at the Campus Health Service we talk about a lot and that we're concerned about. And while alcohol certainly doesn't cause sexual assault, it often is associated with sexual assault in that someone who is taking advantage of another person might use alcohol as a weapon or a tool to facilitate harming that person.
The new legislation requires changes to the way universities handle allegations of sexual assault. It also clarifies the rights for victims of domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking on campus. Dr. Kathleen Young says the added requirements will not be a challenge for the U of A.
Fortunately, we've already been doing a lot of the things that are spelled out in this act in terms of the way these issues are investigated and the transparency, and also the prevention work. The prevention work, the education and outreach, that's the piece that most directly impacts and is related to the work that we do here at the OASIS program.
The Campus Save Act improves data collection on sexual assault and other domestic violence crimes on campus. Now, the annual crime report that universities are required to compile will include incidents of stalking. In 2011, there were 6 cases of criminal sex offenses reported to University of Arizona police. That number was significantly higher than the previous year when 1 criminal sex offense was reported to campus police. Young says those numbers don't truly reflect sexual violence on campus.
We have a number of different options in terms of where and how people can report. So they can report to UAPD. They can report to the Dean of Students Office. They can also report confidentially to the OASIS program. And the OASIS program and me as a psychologist, other mental health practitioners here, are about the only folks who are not required to then pass that information on to the UAPD. So the numbers in terms of what I hear about may be higher than the numbers that are actually reported to UAPD.
The new law requires university officials to provide bystander intervention initiatives to prevent sexual assault. McKendry says the OASIS program at the U of A uses a bystander intervention class called Step Up,
which was developed originally in the UA Athletics Department by Becky Bell around the year 2000. And Campus Health evaluated that program and adapted it and further developed it here from 2009 to 2011 after receiving a Department of Education grant. So we have some great data that shows that students actually are more comfortable and intend to intervene in risky or potentially problematic situations more often after receiving this program and sitting through the presentation and doing some role playing.
She says the program also offers free self-defense classes as a form of risk reduction, which is a requirement under the new version of the Violence Against Women Act.
A lot of students like self-defense classes. We recommend them. However, we don't recommend them as the only form of programming for sexual assault because they require a lot of the person who's potentially the victim, and we like to focus our efforts on the people who are perpetrating, whose fault it is that this is happening, and try to stay away from blaming victims for what happens to them because it's absolutely not their fault.
The new version of the Violence Against Women Act goes into effect next year. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Fernanda Echavarri.
Coming up, a conversation with the one and only Carol Burnett about her classic show, her new book, and why she keeps doing the Tarzan yell. That's right after this break on Arizona Spotlight. Welcome back to the show. For over a decade, Carol Burnett's weekly variety show was one of TV's most consistent successes. With a team of talented friends that included Vicki Lawrence, Harvey Korman, and Tim Conway, Carol would fearlessly tackle comedy and some very big production numbers. Her show's film parodies, like Went with the Wind, remain legendary. But the show also explored the darker side of family relationships with the Mama and Eunice sketches. Both facets of the show came from Carol herself. When she was growing up in San Antonio, Texas, she truly fell in love with the movies, and she would often use movies and comedy as a way to escape her difficult circumstances. She's always been frank about both the good and the bad in her life, and when she appears on stage, Carol still likes to talk to the audience, just like she used to do at the start of every show. I asked her what questions she hears the most.
Well, most often it's, will you do the Tarzan yell? Why do you pull your ear? Is Tim Conway really that funny in real life? How did you find Vicky? But it's all random, Mark. I don't know what anybody's going to ask, and I don't know who I'm going to call. And they just raise their hands, and I say, okay, the man with the red tie. And then whatever they ask, I have to answer. And so it keeps the old gray matter ticking, because I never know what they're going to say.
Can you think of an off-the-wall question you've had recently when you've been doing this tour?
Yes, of course I can. This was a few years ago. I've talked about this, too, because it was so unusual. We were in Texas, San Antonio, where I was born, and this lady up in the balcony was waving her hand. She was wearing pink, and I remember, and she stood out. And I said, yes, lady up there. She said, Carol, if you could be a member of the opposite sex for 24 hours, but then pop back into being yourself again, who would you be and what would you do? And of course the audience laughed because I just looked blank. You know, I thought, oh my God, what am I going to, you know, and I said a little prayer and I said, dear Lord, to myself, I don't know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to open my mouth and whatever comes out is your fault. That's exactly what happened. I had no idea this was going to come out of my mouth until it did. I said I'd be Osama bin Laden and I'd kill myself.
Oh, my.
And I said, thank you, Lord. Yep, the audience went nuts.
That's a showstopper.
Yeah.
Where do you go from there?
That's right.
I think that was something that made watching your show so appealing was that you would be ad-libbing and you would be honest with your answers.
Right.
And I remember someone asking you about your Bob Mackie gowns and you talking about always needing pockets. So you always wanted to have a place to put your hands.
Right.
Where are you at right now in terms of picking and choosing your projects? Do you get offered a lot of things?
Well, yes and no. It depends. Like a guest shot on a sitcom or a show or whatever that I watch and like, you know, I'll try to do it. Right now, I just finished my third book, and Simon & Schuster is publishing it, and it comes out in April, April 9th. And so I'll be doing a lot of promos and going back to New York to do the obligatory talk shows and things like that to promote it. So I'll be really busy in April and May because I'll be doing a lot of Q&As in May, too.
And what about your new book? Tell us about that.
Well, that's about my relationship with my daughter who passed away 11 years ago. And she was quite a character. And we were very close. And she had been writing a story. She was a writer and a performer and a singer and lyricist, all of that. But she was writing a story about a bohemian girl, not unlike Carrie, who has a road trip to Graceland with a mysterious cowboy. And she was writing that when she was diagnosed with cancer. And so the last time she was in the hospital, she asked me if I could finish it for her. And I couldn't. I said, Carrie, you know, those are your characters to write. I don't know. It was almost done, but she had a beginning, part of a middle, and the ending. But she had the middle part needed fleshing out. And so her request had been living with me all these years. And finally, I decided I would write about her and our life together because we had our ups and downs when she was a teenager and how she came out of it and became quite a force in her own right. So I write about that. I write about her crazy drug abuse when she was a teenager and how we got through that, and then how she got her life in gear, and she did several movies and television shows and on and on, and she was really doing well, and then she was diagnosed. And so it's about that. It's about her struggle with cancer. But it's not all doom and gloom. There are some funny moments. And you know, I write about from the minute she was born. And so it's called Carrie and Me, A Mother-Daughter Love Story.
You have often been very revealing in your writing, I think, about your life, your disappointments, mm-hmm. and that pathos also sometimes is certainly evident in your comedy. Course, the Mama's Family sketches come
to
mind.
We one time, just as an experiment when we were doing it, rehearsing, we didn't try to do it as Eunice and Mama. We did it as a straight little 10-minute bit, doing it straight,
okay.
without trying to be funny.
Yeah,
it was so heavy because the writers didn't write jokes. But for that sketch, they wrote character. So when you play it straight, I mean, it's a great acting exercise to say, okay, take this, play it straight, now make it funny, or make this, do it funny, and now make it straight.
I have to say that I was very sensitive as a child to things like that, and those sketches would depress me, tremendously.
I understand.
But I think I learned also a lot about how people can relate to each other unsuccessfully.
The writers, Jenna McMahon and Dick Clare, who wrote that, both had mothers that they totally hated. So that was the premise, you know, that they couldn't get along. It was totally dysfunctional families that they both came from. And when I read it, I immediately thought of Southern or Southwestern. Or Texas. They did not write it with those accents in mind. I did that because I was from Texas, and I just remember people talking like this, and, you know, and I just read it that way, and then Vicki picked up on it, and Harvey, and that's how we did it.
Well, when people ask you about who your major comedy influences were, I mean, mm-hmm. we know you were a big film fan growing up.
Yeah.
But what kind of funny men or women do you think really influenced you the most?
Well, Sid Caesar was my inspiration. And, of course, I loved Lucille's comedy. I loved it. But my whole deal was wanting to do variety. When I was first got to New York and I was checking hats at a ladies' tea room, and which is kind of funny because not too many women check their hats, you know, but I'd get their coats and packages and things, you know. But there was a comedian who stood in for Sid when they were blocking, and we got to know each other and have coffee at the Stage Delicatessen, and he said, would you like to come and watch a rehearsal sometime? I said, oh, yeah. So he sneaked me in, and I sat up in the balcony, and I got to watch a few of Sid Caesar's rehearsals, you know, with Carl Reiner and Howie Morris and Imogene Coca.
Sure.
And it was just great. And I loved his show, and it was live. So I remember I was living in a place called the Rehearsal Club for young ladies interested in the theater. And I won, by the luck of the draw, two tickets to My Fair Lady, which was the biggest hit on Broadway at that time. But it was for a Saturday night, and I gave them to my roommate because I didn't want to miss a Sid Caesar show. Because that was live, and you'd never see it again.
No.
And whereas I knew My Fair Lady would be running forever. So, you know, I gave the tickets away.
You had your priorities.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched the trailer earlier for Funny Ladies, and they showed some clips of you and some other wonderful female comedians. Pat Carroll was there, Phyllis
Pat.
Diller was there.
Uh-huh.
And I know that when Phyllis passed just a few months ago now, we were in tears in the newsroom reading some of her jokes out loud to each other. And we were just sitting there having the biggest gas all day long. And I just thought maybe you could tell us something about Phyllis Diller.
Well, I knew her quite well. She was, in fact, when Carrie, my daughter, was born, she was about 3 months old, and my husband and I came out to California, and we were staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and I had Carrie in one of the little cabanas and everything, and I'd take her into the pool and all, and Phyllis was there. And so we got acquainted. I started to kid her because she was always talking with her, you know, her costumes and about how flat-chested she was.
Mm-hmm.
She had a great figure. But she toned it down with those shifts that she would wear. But we kept in touch. She was a guest on my show. And the last time I saw her, well, a bunch of us used to go out to dinner. We would call with, get this, Phyllis, Dick Martin and his wife, Don Rickles and his wife, Bob Newhart and his wife, Phyllis, my husband and me, and Tim Conway and his wife. Now, let me tell you, you had to know the Heimlich maneuver if you're going to eat with these people. All laughs. And she was, she was in her 90s. And she just held court and so sharp. The body went away, but the mind was always there.
I thought for a second there you were going to tell me that the funniest person was, you know, somebody's wife or something. You're not one of the famous comedians.
That's kind of true, too.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
I think that comedians sometimes, when they're insecure, that's when they really pour it on. But in a group like that, where everyone's comfortable with each other, is there still a sense of, however friendly?
Can you top this?
Yeah, one-upmanship.
Yeah, but not really with this group because they're all very close friends, and they travel to Europe together, like Newhart and the Rickles. They've been all over the world together. They're very close.
What does it mean to you when you're on stage and you hear that belly laugh come from the audience?
Oh. It's a total turn on. It's the most pleasant sound I can think of. That's all I can say.
Do you ever visit your star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame?
No.
Have you ever visited it? Were you there when they commemorated it?
I was fired at that theater where the star is. I was an usher, and I didn't want to seat a couple during the last 5 minutes of a Hitchcock movie. So the manager fired me. So years later, when they said, where do you want your star? I said, right in front of that theater. And that's where it is. And I even have the door I was fired in front of. Because the theater, it was the old Warner Brothers Theater. Now, the people who were in charge of it knew that story about my being fired in front of the door on aisle 2. And they gave me the door. So it's in my house.
Wow.
Yeah, it goes into my study.
Was that the only time you were fired from a job?
Yes. Yeah, it was because I was such a movie nut. I didn't want these people to have this movie ruined by seeing the last 5 minutes of an Alfred Hitchcock movie. I mean, really. And the manager said, what's the matter? And this woman said, she won't seat us. And he fired me.
Oh.
And the movie was Strangers on a Train.
Oh, I love that film.
Yeah.
Farley Granger.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a chance to talk to Alfred Hitchcock? Did you ever get to tell him that story?
No, but I got the poster of Strangers on a Train, and my PR person had told Hitchcock about this, and he signed the poster and drew a caricature of himself.
That's so nice.
Yeah, so that's hanging up in my house.
An American Masters tribute to Carol Burnett will air on PBS 6 next Tuesday, April 9th at 8 p.m. There's schedule information available at azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer for this show was Mark Dugan. The music is by Calexico. I'm Mark McLemore.